So as many of you have been on retreats before know, on the evening time, the talk between 8 o'clock and 9 o'clock, we have question time. So because people are usually too scared to ask the questions in public, we usually ask people to put them on a piece of paper and put them in the question box outside. I didn't see the question box outside. Would somebody be kind enough to bring in the question box? Because this actually also helps save time during interview times. In the interviews, that sometimes the question you ask is the same which the person coming next asked me. So sometimes the same old question. So every interview asks the same question. So it's nice to put them on the question time piece of paper so that we can answer them now.
Ooh,
good work for that. You may have noticed that I've put a sheet of paper on the wall outside by the door, the interviews for tomorrow, the schedule of interviews for tomorrow. There's people who have an interview tomorrow and Saturday, same schedule for Monday and Wednesday. The Sunday, Tuesday and Thursday, I didn't have enough paper, so I'll put that on the board tomorrow. So the interview times, it's 10 minutes. Each person. If you don't want an interview, then just put a cross by your name for that one day so I know that you're not coming. And the interviews will be held next door. You can actually find your way through there. And the interviews will be about 10 minutes each. So please try and be on time for the interviews. And also, keep the interviews to questions about the meditation, not about your private life or about the economy or the state of the war in Iraq. So keep it to sort of meditation. Because this is what we're aiming at in this retreat. Really get the meditation really, really strong. When the Buddha said the threefold practice of a Buddhist, sila, samadhi, panya, precepts, meditation and wisdom, this is what we're really focusing on, the meditation part of it. You've already got enough precepts, you're already good enough. Now we can actually work on the meditation. And from that, the wisdom just flows like a stream. So, let's get some questions now. Here's the first question. There we go. Dear Ajahn, please explain the phrase, the lack of remorse. It is translated like this in the Anguttara Nikaya by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Okay, whenever you do something which is unskillful, then if it's really unskillful, then you always have remorse. You think, oh, I shouldn't have done that. That was a silly thing I did. However, if it's something which was beyond your control, then of course you never have any remorse. I couldn't do anything about that. Comes to mind, I was talking the other day to somebody about one of the Buddhists from a long time ago who became a Buddhist. Interesting story. When we were in our first centre in North Perth, in Magnolia Street, he was actually knocking door to door looking for business as a pest exterminator. So when he... when he knocked on the door of the Buddhist Society, and Ajahn Jagra opened the door and he said, "Do you need any pests exterminated?" And of course Ajahn Jagra started talking about Buddhist principles. And this fellow was there for about half an hour, 45 minutes. And he liked it so much he came the next Friday night, and he was a regular every Friday night. And it's just what happens, you know, even though he had some bad karma with his business, he had some good karma in actually knocking at the right door. So he became a regular, very nice fellow. But unfortunately, one day, he literally fell off a roof and hit his head, and he became crazy as a result. And he had some sort of brain damage on that injury, because he started dressing up like Elvis Presley. And he was in his late sort of 40s, early 50s, and so, and he acted really, really strange. And he came to the centre once, and I was on duty on that time, and he was really, really violent. Pathologically violent, but I managed to calm him down. And because I managed to calm him down, you know, I was his friend from that time on. And every time he had a spell of real craziness, he would ring me up, and I'd sort of go and calm him down. But it happened that his wife rang me and said, "He's really gone crazy again. Can you sort of come and do something?" And at that time, I had the flu. I was in my room. I couldn't even get out to. Come to any sort of meetings in the monastery. I was bedridden, so I just told the monk who came and told me, "I can't come." And the following day he committed suicide. He killed himself. And I've got no remorse, obviously, because there's nothing I could do. It was beyond my control. I did my very best. I was bedridden. I had flu. You know that when you get really flu, you just can't even sort of hardly get up to go to the toilet. So you can understand that that's a lovely extreme case of someone who killed themselves. And if I hadn't been so ill, I maybe could have kept them alive for a little bit longer. But I had no remorse there because there was nothing I could do about it. If there's nothing you can do about it, then there's no reason to have any remorse at all. No need for guilt. Remorse is, oh, if I could have only done something else. You had the chance, you had the opportunity, but you didn't take it. However, if you're mindful, if you try your best, and if you're keeping your precepts, or trying to be kind to others, be kind to yourself, within your limitations, then there's no need for remorse anymore. Too often in this world, that we are almost conditioned to feel guilty. If something goes wrong, and I know as a kid, I was told by my parents, you know, do you feel sad about that? Do you feel guilty about that? And if you said, yes, I did, then you got off lightly. You didn't get punished so badly. And so it became almost like a conditioned response that, you know, when you do something they didn't approve of, you feel guilty, and you get away with it. But it's, you know, a lot of that, I didn't know why I was supposed to feel guilty. I was only being a kid, that's what kids do. So after a while, when you know yourself, you understand who you are, what you're doing, then there's no need to feel remorse or guilt anymore. Except if you really have done something stupid and you wish you hadn't done that. It's much better, instead of feeling guilty, you know that to follow the AFL code, that's what I keep on saying. That's very, over here in West Australia, in Australia, that's very well known. AFL is a code of football, which people go crazy about here in Perth, and especially in Victoria, AFL, the Australian Football League, isn't it? Okay, but AFL in Buddhism means acknowledge, forgive, learn. So you acknowledge you've done something wrong, forgive yourself, so no need for any remorse or guilt or anything, and then learn from it. And that actually comes straight from the teachings of the Buddha, who said that if you acknowledge your fault and are resolved to do better later on, it's called that growth in Buddhism. Growth on the path to enlightenment. You acknowledge you've made a mistake, forgive yourself, learn, in other words, try never to do it again. There's no need to have remorse. Too much remorse is like looking in the past. Oh, if only I hadn't done that. Oh, if only I could have done something else. Oh, if only, only, only. And of course, you can't change the past. It's a complete waste of time. So just let go of the past. Acknowledge, forgive, learn, and let the whole lot go. Does that make sense? AFL code. Acknowledge, forgive, learn. I know these thoughts keep appearing of the past no matter how hard I keep attention on now. Aha! Now I'm sure that many of you understand the problem here. I'll read it out again. I notice thoughts keep appearing of past no matter how hard I keep attention on now. That's the problem. You're putting the attention on the now too hard. When you put the attention on the present moment too hard, it becomes unpleasant. When it's really unpleasant, the mind will want to go somewhere else. Anywhere but now, because you're giving this present moment and your mind such a hard time. It just wants to escape. So never put it too hard on the present moment. Do it really softly. Really so gently in the present moment. And tell the mind, if you want to go somewhere else, you can. I told this story to a couple of Singaporean girls that I'm monitoring at the moment. Now they're I think they left today, go back to Singapore. And one of the girls was saying that she was having a hard time keeping the mind still, it was wandering all over the place. And of course I told her, listen, let it wander all over the place. And I told her a story of one of the people who comes to Nolamara. She told me, this is a very wonderful mother. She had a son. He must have been about 6 or 7 years of age. Decided he didn't like to stay at home anymore because mother was just too strict. The 6 or 7 year old said, right, I'm leaving home. So the mother actually helped pack her bags and made some sandwiches and gave it to this little 6 or 7 year old and said, here you go, have a nice lunch, bye bye. That was a great mother. I really sort of buy her. Because, of course, what the 6 or 7 year old did, it got to the end of the road and then turned around and came back again. You don't need to stop the child going, because 6 or 7 year old child, it knows where its home is. It knows where it's in a comfortable bed and toys and nice food is. So the mother doesn't need to do that. And the reason why this Singapore girl was laughing, because it happened to her. Exactly the same. Apparently she was upset someday when she was that 6 year old, or 7 year old I think she said. She decided to leave home and she was just laughing so much because that happened to her. And her, again, her mother sort of packed her bags for her and gave her some money. And the same thing happened to her. She just went, you know, a little bit down the road and then came back again. Because where could a 7 year old go? That's what your mind is like as well. If your mind says it wants to wander off, pack its bag, give it some money, and say, bye-bye, mind. Have a nice time wherever you go. And your mind will go this way and it'll come back again, just like a little 7 year old kid. That's how you deal with the mind. But if you try and stop it, no, you can't go. No, you have to stay at home. And you lock it in the door. The kid will, you know, climb out the window or find some way out. That's what happens with your mind. If you really try and put it in the prison, it will want to escape. But if you say, oh, mind, if you want to go somewhere, go on, that's all right, I don't care. Yeah, where do you want to go? Go on. Then the mind will stay where it's supposed to stay put. You try that. It's a wonderful thing, this mind. So, don't try too hard. Try very, very softly. With loving kindness, not with ill will. Too much ill will in this person here. They were ill will. They want the mind to be like this. It's like a sort of a boss at work is always telling you, come on, do it properly, come on, come on. You can see the way I teach on this retreat is the way I want you to look after your mind. I don't tell you, 4 o'clock in the morning, you all have to be up here or else. If anyone's here at 4:05, they don't get breakfast. Now you don't do things like that, but some people are like that. Like sort of, you know, like tyrants, authoritarianism. And if I did that, would you come on this retreat? You'd get so tense, so afraid, so uptight, you'd never get anywhere in the meditation. It does not work. Maybe in the world, or if you're, you know, living in a prison or in the army, maybe, but in a meditation retreat, we keep it very, very soft, very gentle. We work with the mind, with kindness. And I work with you with kindness. The way I teach is the way I want you to deal with your mind. The two go together. This is how it works. So don't be too hard. Be really, really soft and really, really forgiving. So gentle. 9 days you've got for this retreat. It just works naturally. As soon as you get out of the way, just allow the mind to be peaceful. It does it by itself. Sometimes a retreat is like, I gave this example of my monastery. A retreat is like you're getting on because there's a few people from Singapore here, you're getting on the plane, going back to Singapore, and some people, they rush up to the front, so thinking they're going to get there quicker. Some people are lazing around by the back, they're not doing anything, and people think, oh, they're not going to get there at all. It does not really matter how much energy you put on this retreat, you're not going to get there anyway. Some people try really hard, some people don't try. It's not up to you. So just sit down. You're on the plane. It takes 9 days. So sit down. Enjoy the in-flight service. Oh, sorry. The in-flight service. Next one. At home, I keep a watch handy to glance at for guide the time. Fitting meditation time into a busy timetable, it can help. I think this is okay. What do you think? Yes, certainly at home. You can put that sort of clock out there. I've got to put a clock out here to make sure that I keep the time. Because again, we'll have interviews later on and I've got to do things. But you don't have to do that. It's great for you because you can just sit here, you have nothing to do. You're absolutely free. Now even the breakfast, it's from what? It's 7 to 8. You know, you can get 7:30 or 5 to 8. There's still something left there. You can sort of sneak something in. And you know, lunchtime, we'll start at 11, but I'm sure that you can still get something at 11:30, 11:45. So you don't have to be on time. So this is like, try to get rid of the having to be on time for this and be on time for that. And if you feel tired in the afternoon, sleep all afternoon and stay up all night. It doesn't matter when you start. Sometimes some monks do that. They prefer to meditate all night because it's quiet and cool. And they sort of sleep during the daytime. Remember one monk did that all the rain retreats on night shift. And it sort of it worked very well for him. So you're free, you don't, you know, use your own body clock when you feel tired and sleep. When you feel like meditating, meditate. So you can get free of time. It was great once. I went actually to Norway once to see the midnight sun up in the North Cape. Once you get into the Arctic Circle in summertime, you know, the sun never goes down. So it's light all day. It's really interesting because, you know, it was midnight and it was, you know, fully light. You didn't know what to do. So, you know, when you were tired, you slept. When you weren't tired, you just kept on going. So you just really went for your body clock because the signs of nature never told you when you're supposed to sleep and when you're supposed to be awake. It's really fascinating. So, here it's just the same. Maybe the next time we can actually have a centre which is all inside and we keep the lights on 24 hours. That'd be really interesting, wouldn't it? So you completely lose track of tidying. Okay, so in the world, yes, because you have other appointments to do, you can actually keep a watch handy. But I will tell you a trick, and this is a trick which will help you, especially when you get into deep meditations. If you have an appointment to make, and you're meditating, instead of having to look at the clock, you know, is it sort of 11 o'clock yet, is it 11 o'clock yet, what you can do, you can make a resolution. You can say to yourself, when you meditate, I've got to come out of meditation at 11 o'clock. Make it very clear, 11 o'clock I've got to get out of meditation. And then forget about it. Just meditate quite happily. You program the mind, and a lot of the time you will get up at 11 o'clock, get out at 11 o'clock. You'll open your eyes, be 2 or 3 minutes either side of 11. If you want to play around with this, it's a nice thing to do on a meditation retreat. Tonight, when you go to sleep, or whatever time you want to get up tomorrow morning, just tell yourself, I want to get up, say, at 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock I will get up tomorrow morning. Set your alarm clock to 5 past 5. You've got an alarm clock, just in case. But just make it very clear to yourself, I will get up at 5 o'clock, I will get up at 5 o'clock, I will get up at 5 o'clock. And just relax and just have a nice sleep. When you hear the bell at 4 o'clock, that's the signal for turning over to the other side. But at 5 o'clock you'll find your eyes are open, you get up, you look at your clock, and it will be about 5 o'clock. Your natural body clock is that good. If you tell yourself, then it works. The first meditation retreat I was told that, and I was surprised. It was just fascinating. But it actually worked. I got up at the time I told myself to get up, without looking at any clock, without worrying. And what that means, it gives you the understanding and the confidence. You can do that even with your meditation. You can say, okay, I'm going to sit for an hour and a half. You just tell yourself that. You don't look at any clock. You finish your meditation. It's time to come out. Hour and a half. Within 2 or 3 minutes either side. So if you're having if you missed your lunch today, or and you really want to make sure you get it tomorrow, you just sit there and you say, I have to get out by 11 o'clock. And it will work. Any comments on that? Okay, the next question coming up. Here we go. As I walked through the open ground of the beautiful trees, flowers, I couldn't help admiring the beautiful sights and sounds of nature. I stood and stared at nature for a few minutes. Am I wrong to indulge in the wonders of nature? I even admired the sapling glue and the seed pod that dropped all over the ground. It's enjoying nature is one of those things which is conducive to the peace of meditation. So you don't need to worry about the beauty of nature. And because nature doesn't move very much, it's not enticing. And you understand you can't own nature. And nature flows according to its own rhythms. It's something you can enjoy without really controlling. And because of that, you can't own it, you can't control it, then it's alright to enjoy it. What is subject to attachment, what is subject to being controlled, that's what you should really avoid. Because if you enjoy that, you want to possess it, you attach to it, and when it sort of starts to disappear, you get really upset and depressed, you suffer. Because you're attaching to things which you can't control. With nature, you know you don't own it. You know it's just nature doing its thing, that's all. So you don't ever try and control it, manage it, change it, criticize it. Doesn't matter which way the tree's leaning, you try and push it the other way, it won't go. So you can't do anything. And this is where the beauty of nature is very conducive to meditation. It teaches you how to let go. It's a way of nature. The flowers come out on the tree. After a while they're beautiful, then they start to decay, and then they go back to the dirt again. So it's the nature of things, like all beings. So the Ajahn Chah, all those forest monks, because they lived in nature, they learned so much from nature. They always used to say they learned much more Dhamma from watching nature than they did from reading the books. So it's great to admire nature. And again, you have the time now to admire nature. In the world, you might look at a tree, but then you've got to remember to get your bus. You might just see, you know, the sunset, but then you remember you've got to be cooking the dinner for your husband. So there's so much work to do. You can't really enjoy nature. So here, enjoy that nature. You go out there. One of the nice parts of this retreat centre, you've got that garden outside. It's one of the great assets of coming here. So enjoy that garden. It'll be conducive to your meditation. And afterwards, you look to the garden, look at the leaves or the trees, whatever, and come and sit down and take that piece into your meditation with you. I've mentioned a lot, and I mention again, probably every day, that the happiness is such an important ingredient to meditation. Now go out there and get happiness from the trees. Get inspiration from the flowers. Get delight, you know, from seeing the seed pods on the floor. And that will be able to help you in your meditation. Later on, as your mindfulness gets even stronger, the nature will get more beautiful. And that garden will be just amazingly beautiful later on. It gets better and better and better. Just as I was saying this morning or yesterday, the food gets more and more delicious as your mindfulness increases and increases and increases. So, as well as having a beautiful garden, you'll find, as your mindfulness gets more and more powerful, the food goes up from 2-star, 3-star, by now, the middle of next week, it'll be 4-star, by the end of this retreat, it'll be 5-star restaurant. Yummy. Any questions about that? Okay, next question. Ajahn Brahm, does Buddhism encourage technological and medical advances and progress, even cultural, artistic or musical advances and activities? It seems to me, as a beginner, Buddhism seems to encourage withdrawal from the hurdy-burdy world of modernism. I might be wrong in my perception. Well, it's like an interesting word in Buddhism called papancha. And the monks know that word very well, and we use it very often. It means like proliferation. A lot of technology comes from drinking too much coffee. It is true. I mean, you can understand why, you know, because the United States, they drink so much coffee. And that's actually just why they've got so much innovation. They can't stop still, they're always sort of thinking about something. In Europe, especially in England, they drink lots of tea. So in tea, it's much more mild stimulant. So they're more into sort of sitting around and chatting and not doing very much. That's what I reckon anyway. And so you've got technological and medical advances and progress. It's really great, isn't it? Is that really progress? I think the jury really should be out on that one. Is it progress or is it not progress? Is a computer really a time-saving device? Is it? I don't think so. It's the effort can do more things and therefore you get more sort of caught up with doing this and doing that. But I really sometimes you wonder whether it's progress or not. And as for medical advances, yeah, I mean, it's a great lot of medical advances, but also a lot of medical regressions as well. So, you know, one doesn't really know. And we're living to a longer age, but then we have to spend those last years in old people's homes. So is it really worth it? But anyway, it's nice to be kind. The Buddhism is, I think, the jury's out on technological and medical advances. Because the spiritual advances is more important than technological and medical advances. If the spiritual advances go alongside, fair enough. And the spiritual advances is learning how to live simply, being at peace, not needing so much. If you don't need so much, you don't consume so much. If you don't consume so much, the world will be in a much better state. We're running out of this, we're running out of that, we're running out of water in the world. So we need to consume less, have less golf courses, drink less alcohol, especially beer. Because you know what happens when you drink beer? I used to drink beer as a young man. You go into the pub, you drink a couple of pints of beer, and then you'd urinate it all out in the toilets. Just go right through you. What a waste of water. Imagine how much beer Australians drink. That's why we haven't got enough water. We waste it all. So I think we should actually ask the government to sort of ban beer and then save a lot of water. Do you think that go down very well? The Australians are really into their beer. So encourage technological and medical advances. Yeah, it's okay if your technological advances and medical advances, but how much do you really need? Especially for monks, because I'm a monk, we try at least have the monks living simple lives. Because people expect monks to live simple lives. There might be somebody in the world, or some place in the world, where you know you don't have to have mobile phones and computers and all this sort of stuff. I really try my hardest to try. Keep mobile phones and the internet and email out of my monastery. I think I'm one of the only monasteries which hasn't got email these days. And it's lovely having that because it's more peaceful. I think people respect that. They don't want a monk to have a mobile phone and a laptop. Sort of, sometimes the idea of a monk, even though you can do much more, people have the idea of a monk, or like a hermit, like a sage, of being someone simple. I think it's nice to keep that ideal. As much as we possibly can. So, encourage. We don't really discourage or encourage it. So it's just, maybe you can do that if you want to, make use of them. But I think the more important is to have spiritual advances. Have people learning to live together. People learning to be more frugal, wasteless. So that we can actually have a happy time on this planet. So, yeah, Buddhism does encourage withdrawal from the hurdy-burdy world of modernism. But not total withdrawal, unless you want to become a monk or nun. Then you can try and withdraw as much as you can. But even as a monk or nun, you try your hardest to withdraw, but then you keep inviting me to teach these retreats. So you can't really withdraw that much. So you try your best. So you have a little bit of withdrawal, a little bit of engagement, a little bit of withdrawal, a little bit of engagement. Anyone got any comments on that one? Buddhism. But remember that Buddhism doesn't tell you what to do. So if you want to get in there, get into the technology, fine. Medical advances, at least it stops pain and suffering, so it's fine. But I think it's great to have Buddhism teaching about mental suffering as well. Mental suffering is far greater than physical suffering. Mental suffering, which is why people commit suicide, not physical suffering. I've always noticed that. Why it is in wealthy societies where there's very little physical suffering, there's no hunger, and if you do get a pain, you can always get some palliative care, or most of the time anyway, you get Panadol, aspirin, or other painkillers. Why is it in these modern societies when there's always plenty of food, a place to stay? But they have the highest suicide rates. You would think that places which were hungry, places where there wasn't much medical help, you'd think because of physical pain that they would want to kill themselves. But it's not physical pain which makes you kill yourself mostly, it's a mental pain. Which actually shows, that's an important point, mental pain hurts much more than any physical pain. That's why anyone who's read any books about torture, I remember reading this book about this prisoner without a name, cell without a number. about this journalist in the Argentina who got taken away by the secret police, put in one of these cells, that's what he called it, like a prison without a name, cell without a number, completely disappeared during the reign of the junta in Argentina, and was tortured, you know, day after day on one of these electronic machines. But he said the worst part, the worst day of that whole, you know, terrible couple of years was when the guards had brought him a letter from his wife. And he was wise enough, he was a very smart man. He told his wife, look, if I disappear, you know, if I get taken away, don't ever write to me. And she did. Because when he read that letter, he had something to compare his present experiences with. When he read the letter, the memory of the happy home life, his wife, his children, the fun and joy came flooding back. And that made the torture and his present predicament hurt 100 times more. It was a very brilliant strategy by the torturers to get that letter to him. That really hurt. The mental pain is far, far greater than any physical pain. That's why you want to kill yourself. So, medical science can deal with the physical pain, but you need something like Buddhism and meditation to deal with the mental pain. And that's the killer. Problem is, the physical pain you can see. You can see a person with a bruise on their body. You can see the person with a wound with blood dripping out. You can see a person with a fever. But can you see a person who's got mental suffering, depression, psychosis or whatever, and they're about to commit suicide? I know so many people, and so many families unfortunately. One comes to mind, just in Rolling Stone, just a couple, they're a Buddhist couple, they're Tibetan Buddhists. They got up one morning, found their son on the veranda, hanging on the end of a rope, 12 years old. No idea at all why he did that. No note, no problems at school. Imagine getting up in the morning to find a 12-year-old who committed suicide right on your veranda. Mental pain, could not see it at all. It was going through that young boy's head, getting so bad that he couldn't stand it any longer. Mental pain is the killer. So, with all the advances, I think without a spiritual advance to go along with the technological and medical advances, we're not really making much advance at all. Any comments on that one? You can join in if you like, if you want to mention anything. Okay, the next one. Is not going into past lives just another distraction? Going into time rather than staying in the now. Okay. If you are going to remember the past, you might as well remember something useful. It's okay finding out about the past every now and again. In this meditation, we let go of the past for a long time so we get into the present moment. We can build up the samadhi. It's only later on during this retreat, but it's a good thing if you can. Use some of the samadhi power, the meditation power, to remember early life or past lives. The reason is because, first of all, it shows you what memory can actually do. You're not supposed to be able to remember when you were a kid. Your memory, your neural pathways, whatever it's called, aren't supposed to have really developed yet. So first of all, it challenges science. Because you're remembering something very clearly, you've got no doubt whatsoever, you're getting your data. And if you can get sort of an earlier memory, like a past life memory, then that's brilliant. Now you don't have to believe anymore about rebirth, you know rebirth. You know there's such a thing as past lives. And that's important for one's insight. Because insight practice is like seeing truths from your own experience. And there's one amazing thing, I'll say this later on about when we talk more about past lives and this sort of stuff. When you get one of those experiences, it's a strange thing, but it always comes with this certainty. It's not the slightest doubt at all when these things really come up in meditation that that was you. And that sort of certainty is one of the hallmarks of those memories. In fact, you're far more certain, it's so clearer than, say, what you had for lunch today. What did you have for lunch today? You've got a sort of memory there, but the memories of past lives are 100% clear. It's that you're right back there. You're really re-experiencing whatever it was. But that actually shows you, you're getting more data to work on what memory is, what mind is, and how it gets reborn. That's why it is very, very useful. In fact, when the Buddha became enlightened, the first thing which he remembered was his past lives under the Bodhi tree. From that, he worked out the law of karma. From that, the Four Noble Truths. So it is very important to do this. And if you can, go for it. You come out of this retreat, you've got something. You've actually remembered some past lives. It would be fascinating that you know you've lived before.
Ajahn, the past last thing, is it possible that you can't remember places rather than yourself in places? Unless you'd like to, for example, you might go to a meeting and go, bang, bang, bang.
There are those deja vus sometimes where you go back to a place and you feel you've been there before. Some of those deja vus are very, very strong and they are past lives. I always remember reading about this British comedian called Rod Hull. Not Rod Hull? Yeah, Rod Hutt. H-U-D-D. He's an old English comedian. He's very, very famous, a household name in the UK. And he wrote this little article that he got lost in London. He took a wrong turn. He went down one of these side streets in his car and literally the hair on the back of his head started standing up. Memories started returning. Not memories of his early life, memories of his previous life. Because you know that London hardly changes over the, you know, even like 100 years. The buildings may have a new coat of paint, but there's so many old buildings there that you can actually recall. They jog your memory. And another thing about London, if you've been there, that they have this society which puts these blue circular plaques on the wall of houses where someone famous has lived. So maybe like Alexander Fleming, who discovered penicillin, you know, lived here. Or, you know, Winston Churchill, you know, lived here. They have all these plaques on the wall. It's quite interesting. There's so much history. And he got to this house. There was a plaque on the wall because he knew he'd lived there before. It was a music hall comedian called Dan Lena. If anyone knows the history of English music hall, he was, again, a very, very famous entertainer. And he remembered that was him in his past life. He knocked on the door of the house because he was like a well-known personality. And they recognised him. Well, you know, what are you coming to our house for? Then he sort of proudly announced, I was Dan Lena before. And it was no joke. He took them around the house and showed them everything about the house, things they didn't know. And he wrote an article in a magazine about it. And sometimes that was like just a chance encounter, going the wrong way down the street, and the old houses, because they haven't changed very much, jogged his memory, and he recalled a previous life, just like that. But in the past life memories in meditation, you haven't got anything to jog your memory, you just tell your mind to go back. It's very, very, very clear. And that's the nice thing about it. The clarity means there's no doubt at all. And it's great, I encourage people to do that, because you start getting something out of your meditation, and it's actually fun. It just shows you this meditation is no joke. You can actually get some powerful states of mind out of this, and you can remember early things. And it's also, it's great marketing to get people coming to the next retreat. Oh, isn't it? I think I'm going to go for this one. So yes, it's good to do. But don't try it yet. You need very, very good samadhi. That's what we do towards the last couple of days of the retreat, if you're really getting it going. Okay, when moving from silent awareness onto the next stage of the breath, according to your book of meditation, you should be able to have prolonged periods of silent awareness. How long is a prolonged period? Say using an hour-long sit as a guide amongst all the thoughts coming or going, what are prolonged periods? Really, just sometimes it's very hard to say how much you need of silence. But at least, you know, you have moments of silence, long moments, minutes of silence, where there's not any commentary going on inside the mind. So at least you know spaces between the commentary. And as long as you've got spaces between the commentary, you've got some silence there, then you can go on to the breath and you can increase that silence. But if the mind is always having a commentary, it's always saying something, it's always like this talker inside, it never shuts up. And if you go into the breath while that talker, the inner talker, is still going, soon you lose the breath very quickly. Because the talker will be, you know, taking you away on its dialogue, on its monologue, say. So at least have moments, you know, minutes, when there's no inner speech going on at all. You're just listening quietly and nothing's happening. In traditional Buddhism, they call this establishing mindfulness in front of you. Many people talk about mindfulness, but it's very hard. What is mindfulness? They say there's all levels of mindfulness. Here, the mindfulness required before you start watching the breath is present moment awareness, because that's where you're mindful. Now, if you're off in the future, off in the past, you're not really mindful of what you're doing or where you are. Present moment. And you're not mindful of the speech, you're mindful of what's happening. Not the commentary, but the thing itself. So this is actually starting off in gaining mindfulness. And that's actually the preparation there. Once you are mindful, then you're mindful of the breath. Yeah.
How much credence can you give to this past life regression that some people claim they can do it?
And those people who have past life regression, this is actually usually through a therapist or a hypnotist. Some of those are true, some of them aren't true. This is uncertain, so we can't really always believe what they say. Some of the things they say are obviously wrong, but some, you know, are actually correct. Because of its uncertainty, we can't trust it. But when you do this through deep meditation, there is certainty there. And that's this difference.
I read a book by this Brian Wise. He wrote a book called Life After Life.
Ah, yes, yeah.
Many Life, Many Masters, sorry.
Yes, yeah.
It was a bestseller and I read.
Oh, it's great. If you get your past life and write a book about it, you can make a lot of money. Because people love stories like that. Just like it's told in Singapore that one of the TV channels, they ask people to write up about their ghost stories. What a brilliant idea, because everyone's got ghost stories, and they've heard it here. It doesn't matter if it's true or not. And they put it on the TV, and they got other actors, or they did it. And it was high ratings. People loved it. Singapore Ghosts, or whatever it's called. If anyone knows anyone sort of in Perth, it's a great idea for a TV, because people love ghosts. They're scared stiff of them, but they love. If we tell ghost stories here, then we can go on all night, and you never feel tired. I really love it, talking about this ghost and that ghost story. So it's same like past lives. Or what was that fellow who was Edwards or something? He was he was a medium, telling people about, was it passing over or going over or something? And people loved it, even though it was all rubbish. People loved that sort of stuff. It's interesting. I always loved sort of weird stuff. So, yeah, regression, they can make heaps and heaps of money out of that. If you really want to be into that business. But really, it's not to make money out of your past lives, it's just actually to know for yourself, with certainty, that was me in the past. Because that changes, you know, a lot of your religious views, your ethical views, your spiritual views. Because otherwise, you know, so many different religions around, which one are you going to choose? Are you sure you've got the right one? And if actually you find out for yourself, find out some really powerful truths. That's actually really great. You don't have any doubt anymore because you know there's such a thing as rebirth. It's not belief anymore, it's knowledge. Experience. And I want more and more people to get those experiences because sometimes we don't believe in rebirth. Most of Western society doesn't believe in rebirth. And some Asian society becomes embarrassed by believing in rebirth, even though it's true. And it'd be marvelous. The consequences of many people understanding that this is not your only life means that we won't get so upset when somebody dies. There'd be far more less tears in the crematoriums. And we won't be so upset when young people die as a young life, or not so many years, now you get an old life, now you get a middle life, here we go again. And we will be much more caring with our old people, because the reason why our societies in the West do not look after the aged people, because we think there's nothing in it for us. Why look after elderly people? What will they contribute to society? We put all the resources into children because they're our future. Wouldn't it be wonderful to think that our old people are our future? They're our children who are going to come back next. We better look after them. And it is my theory, because we do not look after the old people, they come back as our children and they get their own back. That is why we have all the problem with youth, because we didn't look after them when they were old people a few years before. Karma, get on that. So if we could look after, if we knew they were going to come back again, we'd look after them. We'd care for them. We'd invest resources in our aged, because we know that it's in our interest in the future. Our old people are our future. Isn't that a wonderful saying? It's also when you're old, you realise, you know, you're not the end. It's just another pause. It's the end of a day, there's another day coming next. You're not so upset, you don't get so depressed. I'm old. What's the point now? All I've got to look forward to now is the nurse coming in and changing my nappy. You get bored in nappies, you end up in nappies. The only thing I can look forward to is my funeral. When am I going to die? And if you realize you're going to, you know, live again, it's none of all that. So it's much, much better. So if people believe in rebirth, it's also, you realize, karma goes with reincarnation as well. The two go together. Because actually, when you look at your past lives, you understand why you get reborn in this way. All the causes. And that means you don't get away with anything. And there's too many people getting away with things. And they can go bomb Iraq and so what? They can go and kill someone, they can sleep with somebody else's wife or husband. Think, so what, I can get away with this. If you're smart, you can just hire a good lawyer. If you're rich enough, you don't need to go to jail. You don't get away with anything, it comes around in the end. If people did that, they'd be much, much more honest and more ethical. So reincarnation and karma, which comes along with it, could change just the way we live in our world in so many ways. Those are just examples. That's why I think it's really important that more people could actually get their knowledge of their past lives, so we can actually change our world. Any other questions on that one? Comments?
Hi, Sam. For those who remember past lives, whether you're a male or a female, or whatever culture you were born in, is there some similarity with your, I don't know how to put it, with your mind and with your nature?
Yeah, it's,
that follows
yeah.
through from life to life, which shows us that we really aren't all the same. Like what I'm trying to say is, one of the benefits perhaps of remembering past lives be that you get possibly an insight into what type of mind and nature you actually have, and therefore perhaps, well, possible you, that there are people who have had laid back natures life after life. There are people who have been, who have anxious kind of natures life after life. And so the work that you need to do as well as with the karma is also to work with what is your nature.
Yeah, what you actually say, yeah, I understand what you're saying. It's very often that it is the character traits keep on going from life to life to life to life. It's like the simile of like, I've been giving recently the simile like a mango. A mango drops from a tree, you eat the mango, you plant the seed. And from that seed another mango tree grows. And the mangoes from that second tree, they are connected to that first mango, but there's nothing going across. It's, you know, the DNA is all different. And the no molecules from the original mango in the new mango. But there's something which is similar there. It carries the trace. If the previous mango came from a very sweet tree, this is a sweet mango. Not quite the same, but it changes slightly. At every generation, there's a slight mutation. And just after maybe many years, the mango might not be so sweet anymore, after many sort of generations. This is actually, human beings are the same, or beings. Our character changes little every lifetime. And so there are some character traits which you can recognize. Yeah, you know, you were anxious last lifetime, you're anxious this lifetime, but maybe a little more, maybe a little less, depending on how you train yourself. You may be very generous, you were very generous in your last lifetime. You learn. It sometimes takes a long time to change our character. But it can be done. And this is actually how we can actually see, sort of over many lifetimes, the character traits change as we learn through our experience of many lives. And that's one of our jobs. So that's actually, people from the past lives, sometimes you can remember, because you've got certain characters in your past life and you keep them for this life as well. And that's sort of sometimes recognizable. But they're not always permanent. They sort of they grow and they diminish according to one's practice. Okay. Next. When moving from science awareness onto the next. Oh, I did this one already. Okay. Oh, yeah. Wait, how long is prolonged periods? Okay, there's another half of this question. I've already done that one already about how much time you need before you go on to the next one. Next stage. I was told by another monk from your monastery, if I practice silent awareness and sustain attention in the present moment for the rest of my life, that would be very good. I found this disheartening. I aspire to move through to advanced stages of the meditation in this life. Do you have any feedback on this? That was a very smart monk. Because he was telling you that you could be content. They said, if you just practice silent awareness to sustain the attention of the present moment for the rest of your life, that would be very good. If you really followed that advice, then you would develop the deeper stages of meditation despite you. It's contentment causes the deep states of meditation. This is good enough. And then the other stages will come. But if you want to, if you aspire to go to the deep stage of the meditation, you will get nowhere. Desire is not the way. Wanting just stops you being peaceful. Craving creates suffering. Noble truth number two. I've said many times, you all know this by now, I've got to figure out new jokes and new clever questions. But in Singapore, Australia, I ask people, the Buddha taught two types of meditation. What are those two types of meditation? Now, before people heard this, they would say, Samatha Vipassana, that's the usual answer. And I say, no, that's the wrong answer. It is really the right answer, but I say it's the wrong answer just to make a point. The two types of meditation the Buddha taught, or the two types of meditation which people practice, rather, are Second Noble Truth Meditation and Third Noble Truth Meditation. You know that one? Well, you know, because I was taught that, I think, a couple of days ago, I think, in Singapore. Second Noble Truth Meditation. Craving, 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 wanting, wanting, wanting. I want to get my past lives, now I've talked about this. My past lives, come on. I want to get jhanas. I want to get this bliss better than sex for Jagan Parvasis. Didn't get it last time I came here, but I'm going to really go for it this time. I want. That's called craving. And the second noble truth, this is fundamental teachings of the Buddha, the second noble truth said, craving leads to suffering. So if you really, really, really want to see your past lives, you really, really, really have a lot of suffering. If you really, really, really want to get this better than sex, you get suffering, real suffering. So wanting is second noble truth meditation. Third noble truth meditation, letting go, contentment, relinquishing, no control. That's the way to Nibbana, the Buddha said. Powerful teaching. And that's the way we're meditating here. Contentment, letting go. Ma wants to go somewhere, off you go. It's all right with me. Come content, whatever you do. If you get jhanas, fine. If you don't get jhanas, fine with me. It's good enough. That is the way to get jhana. I find previous styles, that's okay. If you don't, that's okay. It doesn't matter. I'm okay. That's the way to get previous lives. Because of your contentment, letting go of controlling, letting go of craving, giving up this, you doing the meditation, getting out of the way and allowing it to happen, putting down the cup rather than trying to hold it and make it still, put it down even alone. This is the third noble truth meditation. That's what leads to Nirvana. Have you put down your body yet during this retreat? Sat here and just completely forgot about the body, watching the breath or present moment awareness and found your body is so still, doesn't move at all. It's proving this is a way to develop tranquility of the body. Just leave it alone. It's still. You tried that when you go to bed at night? I don't care whether I go to sleep or stay awake. Just put down the whole problem and you go to sleep straight away. But you try and make yourself go to sleep by holding the cup, you just can't do it. You can't keep it still. You let go and it happens by itself. Because to go to sleep, you need to relax. To go to jhanas, you need to relax. To see past lives, you need to be still. So this is actually why there are two types of meditation. Second Noble Truth Meditation and Third Noble Truth Meditation. If you try Second Noble Truth Meditation, I'm going to get it. Then you're just going to get suffering. So that monk was very smart. I don't know who it was. They deserve a medal. Because he said, just to start the way to sustain attention for the rest of your life, that'd be good. What he meant was, if you just do that, you'll get all the jhanas anyway. But if you say, but I want to aspire to more advanced things, then you're putting an obstacle in front of you. Do you understand? Now do it. When my meditation was going well last night, my legs were jerking about with energy. Does this mean that I was in an I think I'm going to sort of give a prize to the best question. And this, I think, gets the best one question this evening. When my meditation was going well last night, my legs were jerking about with energy. Does this mean that I was an Irish folk dancer in a previous life? That's a classic. Do I need to do anything about it other than watch? Next time that happens, please come up front and give us a performance. Here's a great question. Seriously though, that if that does happen to you, that your things go jerking about with energy, leave them alone. A lot of the time, serious, that it's when you get very peaceful, the body's energies balance themselves. You might say it calls the chi balancing itself, the energy in the body, the winds in the body, as the Buddha would have said, balancing each other, balancing themselves. Leave it alone. Just watch, it will just disappear by itself. Very often, we do have tensions in our body, tight areas of our body. When we let go and our meditation gets very peaceful, there's a balancing that happens sometimes. I know that some might say their arm goes up and they just can't stop it. I don't know why it does that. All it is just a balancing of energy. Leave it alone, it'll disappear by itself after a while. That's one of the things which happens. But if your arm does go up, make sure you're sitting a long way from the person sitting next to you. Otherwise, you're great question. Thoughts keep coming to me. How can I stop it and carry on with my meditation? Similar to the first question here, don't try to stop them. Use the simile of the little Singapore girl. I want to leave home. Just pack the bags for your thoughts. Give them a bit of money, some sandwiches, and say, bye-bye, thoughts. Have a nice time wherever you go. And then if you let the thoughts won't go anywhere. They'll just disappear. Contentment is what stops thinking. If you try too hard, it's called discontent, and make you more waves. Last question. How can we not be born again? And how can be not born again end life, this birth itself? How can we not be reborn? By coming to a retreat like this, by following the instructions and not being stubborn, and when it gets to the time of your time, going to take a rest. That's how you're not reborn again. And if it doesn't work, and you are reborn again, so you, I probably won't be around for you to complain. So this is actually how you stop rebirth. You don't get reborn again. You have to just really make the mind very peaceful and quiet. You get into deep states of meditation to find out what the cause of birth is. Once you actually know rebirth and karma, what the Buddha found out was like dependent mutination, the paticca-samuppada. This is actually how rebirth happens. Why you get reborn. And basically it's because of two things. Number one is craving again, because you want to be reborn. You haven't done yet with the world, with samsara. You want more experiences. You want to do it again. Especially if you've got some attachment, maybe to a person, you want to live with them again. With your kids, you want to see them grow up again. You want to be rich again. You want to go to work on a Monday morning again. You want to get married to a husband again. You want to have kids again. My goodness. I can't understand women sometimes, because once they've had their kids, you know, and they've all grown up, you think they've got rid of them. That's marvelous. Now you're free. But then they put all this pressure on their sons to have grandchildren. Our sons and our daughters. Come on, have you got get married yet? Come on, have another child. So we always want more children to worry about. We just worry so much. And if we don't worry about our own family, then we go and watch these soap operas like Neighbours or EastEnders and worry about somebody else's family. We just love to worry. You know why we like worrying? Because we're afraid. We're afraid of peace. Anything to distract us. Rather than just sit down and do nothing. So that's that craving. And it's endemic in us. We're always wanting to do things. Even now, I'll just say, just do nothing. Relax. Whatever happens, just leave it be. That's the way to end thought. End movement. End craving. If you can't do that now in this retreat, you can't sit still and just let things stop. How do you think you're going to be able to do that when you die? You won't be able to stop thoughts. It will go on and create another life for you. You won't be able to stop craving and doing and controlling. It will just create another world for you. That's how you can actually see in this meditation retreat how you make a new birth. How you just keep on going for something more, something new, something else. Always going on to the next thing, never going in to where you are now, never stopping, always going. That's how we stop birth. Stop it now.
John, so that you just want to get out there and go and experience everything in life, you're saying that's the cause for rebirth.
Yeah, that's also, I'm going to stop rebirth. That's also the cause for rebirth. That's called Vibhavadhamma in Pali. Able to stop. We're still doing things. It's like the person now, I'm going to stop thinking. You can't do that. You just make more thoughts. Just got to let go. Leave it alone. And the whole thing just becomes peaceful all by itself. Just, it gets cool. The energy of rebirth stops. The craving, the wanting, coming here, going there, getting this. All that heat inside the mind all cools and becomes really cool. Whatever happens is fine. And then that's where you stop. You're done. Okay, those are some great questions. And the prize goes to the Irish I think the next meditation I'm going to keep my eyes open and see his legs jerk. Find out who that was. Okay, great. So, it's now just 6 minutes past nine. So, sorry, I've got the time wrong. It is 6 minutes past now. That's right. So, don't you, can you look at the clock and think, oh, it's 9 o'clock. I've got another 50 minutes before I go to bed, or whatever, or 2 hours, depending on what your bedtime is. Who cares what bedtime is? If you feel happy and you feel like carrying on meditating, meditate. If you want to have a walk outside, just walk outside, under the trees in the night time. Nice and quiet out there, nice and peaceful. And when you go to your room and meditate there, have a sleep, whatever you want to do. And just see you sometime in the morning. Have a nice night.